It's time to get strong, fit, and resilient. Welcome to the Fear Being Average podcast with your host, Brandon Rinka, where Brandon shares insights, practices, and education on leveling up how you look, feel, and perform. Say goodbye to complacency and get ready to kick the door into a new standard of living.
I'm here with Gareth Sapstead, a UK fitness expert. Very excited to be talking to you, man. I've been reading your stuff for probably the last year and a half, especially over COVID. You were really coming up with some unique workouts. especially from T-Nation, as a lot of body weight stuff. And you kind of became known as a guy who got very creative with your workouts and your modalities. And I think anybody who read your stuff probably learned a lot over COVID and probably kept their gains going. So congrats on that for sure, man. And you've been busy. You got a book. You got a whole bunch of crazy stuff right now going on. You just had a newborn 12 weeks ago. How's life, man? Let's start there. How's life with you?
Yeah, good. Thanks. As you say, it's a little bit different now versus the COVID years. You know, I'd say we're kind of just coming to the end of those, you know, with lockdowns and things like that being lifted in most countries anyway. And as you say, right at the beginning of those lockdowns, especially over here in the UK, we had some quite severe lockdowns where it was like, you're not allowed to leave the home unless it's A, to get food, or B, to go out for a once a day walk. And that walk is like your exercise. That's it. That's all you're allowed to do. So we were quite kind of severe with those lockdowns, which meant that luckily at the time, I did have a bit of a garage gym set up. I had most of the things that you can you know, use to get a great workout. I had a good power rack in there, you know, barbell plates, probably dumbbells up to like 30 kg. So it was enough for me. So really, as you say, with especially regards to social media and the articles and stuff I was producing at that time, it was mostly out of necessity and actually based around how I was training myself. So I was using a lot of resistance bands instead of cables, for example. So, you know, my philosophy when it comes to social media is just, let's just film something that I, you know, that's interesting that I'm doing and that other people will find interesting. So I was just filming stuff that I was generally using as a bit of a workaround, a kind of a MacGyvering something up to help myself get in a good workout. And that's just kind of the stuff I was sharing. And then that ended up being stuff that I was writing about on T-Nation and various other websites at that same time. So since then, obviously my own training and same with my clients, it's kind of all got back to normal. So everyone's back in the gym and actually using what I've learned during lockdown and those limited equipment workouts have actually enabled me to help my clients better, because let's face it, at the end of the day, gyms can be busy. We don't always have access to all the equipment that we want to be having. We like to mix it up and be creative sometimes. You know, workouts are just as much about psychology as they are the physical side of things as well. So some of that stuff has ended up creeping into my clients' workouts as well and into my own training. But yeah, just good to be kind of out of lockdown, out of all lockdowns. As I said, I've got a 12-week-old baby at the moment, so trying to fend off the dad bod at the moment. I'll be honest, I've gained about a kilo since having him. But in all fairness, I was actually cutting just before we had him. So that kilo, you could say, a little bit kind of a bit more kind of glycogen retention. I'm not as flat anymore. So you can kind of forgive me for the extra kilo gained, but not gaining the dad bod just yet.
I love it, man. So kind of going off that, how have you balanced? I'm sure you've had a lack of sleep. I'm sure you've had to cut down on training volume, training frequency. How have you balanced that? Because for me, it's easy as a 32-year-old trainer with no kids right now for me to kind of, you know, talk about, hey guys, let's be consistent. Let's go to the gym. Let's do this thing on a daily basis. But I also have a lot of empathy knowing that, like, I don't have 3 or 4 kids at home. I don't have a wife next to me. I have a girlfriend, by the way, so I want to make sure if she listens to this, she knows I'm not a shout out. But, you know, I still live on my own. So I understand my lifestyle is much different than most of my clients who are late 30s, early 40s. So I love when I have, you know, I know you're 12 weeks in, so I'm not going to say you're an expert father yet, but how have you managed to balance the fitness industry and the fitness side of you and obviously being there as a new father?
Good question. I'm really lucky in that I've got a very understanding girlfriend. Yeah, the mother of my child. She's really, really understanding in that, A, you know, it's part of my work. Going to the gym, it's part of what we do, isn't it? As far as I'm concerned, you've got to practice what you preach. You know, if I'm saying to people that have got, you know, 6-month-olds, 12-year-old kids, whatever, that, you know, you've got to find the time to be able to work out, you can't use your kids as an excuse, then I've got to be practicing what I preach when I'm saying those types of things as well. So she's really understanding in that she does allow me that time during the day to kind of escape the mayhem that might be happening at home. You know, a constantly crying baby or a dog that, you know, is starved of attention right now because the baby's getting all the attention, so he wants even more attention. So there's kind of that going on at home at the moment. But for us, it was about finding the right schedule. So based on when the baby's sleeping, we can kind of predict when he's sleeping, feeding, whatever during the day. So I know for us that most days around 8:30 in the morning, I can go to the gym. I've got an hour to get that in, and then I've got to be back to kind of, you know, give her an hour. We might swap. So she might go to the gym. She's just started to get back into the gym herself after 12 weeks, you know, just a couple of days a week. So I might come back, take him for a walk. And again, that's something I can manage to fit within my schedule as well, because I might get back from the gym. I've maybe done some filming or maybe done some recording. I might have even answered some of my clients' emails while I'm at the gym. I'm kind of killing two birds with one stone. And then when I come back, I kind of use that as a little bit of my cardio time. So whereas before I might have done, say, 20 minutes of steady state cardio at the end, whatever, just to get my step count up for the day. I actually get back home. Girlfriend goes to the gym. I chuck on like a front-loaded carrier, put in my baby, grab the dog. So I'm going for basically like almost like a weighted walk, really, almost like a weighted vest I've got strapped on me, but it's a baby. And then I go for a 40-minute walk, and I've got my steps in, I've got my steady state cardio in, I've got the dog walk done, girlfriend's at the gym and happy. So it kind of fits in really well just because we've got that schedule nailed down. But the only issues we have is, and again, she's really understanding on this, is that the rest of the day after that is mostly me sat in front of a laptop, or I'm doing a few client one-to-one sessions. I don't do many in-person training sessions nowadays. They're more one-offs, they're more workshops and things like that. But I do have a very, very small handful of good clients that I've been seeing for years that I train out of my garage. And I might only do 3 or 4 sessions a week or something like that at the moment. But they're people that kind of rely on me. So I might have them in the afternoon, or as I said, I'm sat on my computer. But as I said, she's really understanding in that, you know, that's like my work time. And, you know, if I can't get my work done with a screaming baby in the background or whatever, then she knows that I've got to pick up my laptop and go down to a Starbucks or whatever and be that Starbucks guy sat in the corner with his Mac. So, and I try and avoid being that person, but if that's what needs to happen, that's what needs to happen. So for us, it's just about making sure that when I need to be present, when I need to be doing stuff with the baby, I'm there, I'm giving full attention. And then I'm also doing the housework and things like that at the same time. But when I also can't be there, then I'm trying to get as focused as I possibly can with my work. And things like writing articles, that's taken a bit of a back burner at the moment. I haven't been writing much lately just because I can't get those few hours of focused work.
Yeah.
So like I've got probably 5 or 6 articles on the go at the moment, but they're everywhere. There's, you know, a few hundred words in that one. There's a few thousand in that one, just because I can't get that focused time. So that's probably the only thing that's kind of letting me down at the moment. But as I say, it's as you say, it's 12 weeks in, you know, I don't have all the answers. We're just kind of figuring these things out as we go. But the one thing I found, or we found, was that just getting into that schedule, getting into that routine, was key. And as I said, just having an understanding girlfriend is a big part of that.
Yeah. I feel like the preparation that you guys are at least putting into the scheduling and the mindfulness of how to kind of work around the situation is key, right? And sometimes you got to just understand it's not going to be ideal, right? Maybe you're not going to be able to do your hour and a half workout and do your straight sets and do your, you know, full body or kind of body part split workouts. Maybe got to like, you know, just kind of mindfully reconstruct that. I was even watching the, you probably know Jason Brown, of course.
Yeah.
And he had a video the other day, right, where he was doing yard work and he was coming in between yard work. He was doing the 6, 12, 25 hypertrophy method. And, you know, he's wearing jeans, he's getting after it. And he's talking about sometimes you got to manage doing the yard work with your workout, right? And is it the most ideal situation? No, but he still gets his lift in. He still gets house work done. And it seems like right now, at least you kind of have a good schedule. Like you said, having a very supportive girlfriend is going to be a huge reason for that as well.
Absolutely. Jason Brown's a really good friend, really nice guy. And he can, you know, I think he's a few years ahead of me with his kids. I think he's got two. And so he's kind of got things probably a little bit more figured out than what I do. But similar to me, he's got that awesome garage gym set up. He can do what he needs to do. And he understands that, you know, he's going to be getting in his workouts, but his workouts might not be according to what he's written. Or I don't know, let's say he wants to be doing a push, pull, lower split. Well, if he doesn't have that time during the week to do a push and pull and a lower, I think today he posted something and he had to do a push and a pull and a lower all together in the same workout. You know, it ends up being a full body session because it's all you can get done. So you've got to be willing to adapt on the fly as well. But yeah, you almost can't be seen as kind of that selfish person as well in terms of, look, I'm crying, baby. It's 8:30 a.m. I'm leaving now. Bye. You know, I can't be doing that. So yeah. Though, like, it's kind of scheduled. Sometimes it won't be until 9:30 that I'm going. Or if he's quiet, I might get out the door at 8 a.m. or whatever. So yeah, as I say, it's when kids come along, you just have to be a little bit more flexible thing with things, and as I suppose a little bit less selfish. You can't be spending 2 hours on chest, you know.
doing your TED exercise chest day, eh?
You can't be doing that.
No. So Gareth, how did you start in the fitness industry? Where did this kind of desire and I guess passion grow from?
So I actually started in the strength and conditioning industry. So all my formal education, internships and things like that were in strength and conditioning. So I grew up playing rugby to quite a high level, to like a county, district level, regional level, and then for a really elite academy in the UK. So almost the equivalent of like a rugby equivalent of like a probably an Arsenal football team kind of equivalent in rugby. So fairly high level. And then I just got to the age of 18 and just decided that actually I didn't enjoy playing rugby as much as I enjoyed training for rugby. And it was actually the gym side that I enjoyed more than stuff on the field. So it just kind of made sense at that point just to kind of, okay, I should probably pursue that because I like that. But I don't actually like the sport as much. So it kind of put me down that kind of avenue. And then through formal education, so through undergraduate, master's degree, et cetera, and having internships at rugby clubs, football clubs, all kind of at that premier level or kind of in the two tiers below, kind of taught me down that strength and conditioning route. And that enabled me to work with a lot of elite athletes at kind of the highest level. But also what they used to do is they used to give me a lot of the kind of the academy players to work with. So I had at some places kids as young as 12 years old who wanted to kind of be the next best thing. So you're going from training, I don't know, a 21-year-old elite rugby player to training a 12-year-old who doesn't know what a dumbbell looks like. So you're having to always kind of adapt on the fly and have a very, very, very big skill set with training a massive variety of people. At the same time as doing that and doing those internships and things, because internships, I don't know what it's like over there, but in the UK, you don't get paid for it. The strength and conditioning field is very, very kind of take. So all these big clubs just want to get as many interns in as they possibly can, not pay them any cash. The intern's great for their CV, but they're not getting paid for it. So at the same time as you're getting exposure with a club, you're working with elite athletes, you get to put that in your CV and it might take you somewhere. You have to earn money elsewhere. So I was also a personal trainer at like a big box gym. That was what I was being paid to do, you know, an hourly rate. And I was working with your average Joes there. So at the same time as training the elite athletes, the 12-year-old, you know, wannabes, and then, you know, your 50-year-olds who have got cranky knees and backs and just want to be able to walk up some stairs or whatever sometimes without any pain, you're having to have this massive skill set of things. And that's, I suppose, where the whole, I suppose, the creative, the maverick side of things comes from, in that I've just got a very large skill set of things, and just working with different people and having to adapt things for a lot of people, it just kind of opened my eyes to seeing a lot of things, and understanding that, you know, N doesn't equal, you know, N does equal one, you know, everyone's completely individual. Everyone's different. You know, every 12-year-old wannabe rugby player is completely different. So, you know, hence you should be training for that as well.
I feel like that's one of the benefits. I know big box gyms can kind of get a bad rap sometimes because trainers get paid whatever, not minimum wage, but they don't get paid as much as you hear what trainers can get paid on their own. But at the same time, like, you're getting fed clients, and you're getting a lot of exposure to a variety of clientele. Like you said, you could be getting the athlete, you could be getting the complete novice, you could be getting the person who's been working out for a while, but they have the cranky knees and the cranky back, or you know, unactivated glutes, whatever, right? And you get this exposure to so many different peoples and avatar that your skill set really has an opportunity to become very strong, because you're getting so much versatility to your training, right?
100%. And I'll be honest, especially in the early days, you don't really have the ability to turn people down either.
Oh.
So, you know, if you're an 18-year-old trainer at a big box gym and you need to, you know, you need to make some cash to pay your rent or to pay your parents' rent or whatever, then you're not going to be turning down clients because you're not sure about how to train them. So if a 70-year-old walks through the door and they've got some kind, I don't know, let's say they've got some kind of, let's say they've got a meniscus tear or something like that, you're not, as an 18-year-old trainer, you're not really that educated in that. You know, you're a personal trainer, you're not a physical therapist or anything like that. So as an 18-year-old young trainer with hardly any experience with that type of person, you're not saying, sorry, no, I can't train you. You're always going to be saying, yeah, no problem, we can sort that out, no problem. But then when you go home, you're, you know, reading your textbooks, you're Googling things, you know, you're looking on PubMed or whatever and how to train that person. And every time someone like that comes through the door with a completely different issue, whether it's diagnosed, undiagnosed, whatever, you're having to go home and research that stuff. Mm-hmm. So by not training necessarily one avatar, one type of person, you're getting exposed to all these different things. And that just gives you that very broad skill set. So when it comes to even training, let's say training that elite rugby player who's had the same issue with their meniscus, then you've kind of got that background to work with that person. Yes. You know, there's lots of carryover with a lot of things, but being exposed to a really wide variety of people does enable you to kind of get better at training everyone, really. And as I say, you know, I mostly do online coaching nowadays. I do encourage any online coach, listen to this, spend some time, I hate the term, in the trenches, but spend some time in the trenches, you know, with some sweat on the floor in the gym, actually working with some real people to gain that skill set, understand completely different people and who you might like to work with, all those various issues out there. How people speak in a gym as well is a big one, because that's, you know, communication is a big thing as well. And then, yeah, transition into online coaching or like a hybrid coaching model. But again, you get that big exposure to a lot of people.
Well, you would hope that would almost be a prerequisite, that you do spend a few years in the trenches. You do have some actual legitimate, tangible experience working with people, seeing how people move. And, you know, like I said, educating yourself on the process. And I think I kind of want to go in this direction of nowadays, it's not watered down, because, you know, fitness is always going to be a thing, but there's way more options out there now, obviously, especially over the pandemic, to become an online coach. If you looked good, you kind of looked the part, and you kind of knew what some popular exercises were, guess what? You could be an online coach now, right? Because you're selling your body, and you're selling that the hip thrust is good for the glutes, and the push-up or the bench press is good for the chest. Like, that's not hard to figure out. Go Google it, and you're going to be able to find it in 5 minutes. So what's your take on the fitness industry? Because I feel like there's a lot of good. Obviously, like, I'm in this industry. I'm an advocate of it. But it also, at the same time, it's really hard to distinguish the good from the bad. And obviously we're in this position now where we have more resources than ever. We have more opportunity to connect with experts and hear what they're saying and pick up their books and read their free articles than ever before. Yet we're experiencing this obesity epidemic and people are struggling more than now than ever. I know it's not causation equals correlation. There's a lot going on and, you know, access to food and convenience and accessibility and, you know, staying at home and working from your desk. But where do you see the industry going, and what are some things that you really like about the industry and some things that you're like, that we need to fix this as fitness experts?
Good question. As you say, it's access, isn't it? Nowadays, we have massive access. So whether it be access to train with literally anyone we want to in the world. So as an online coach, or if you're looking for an online coach, you can literally train with anyone you want to in the entire world, find them on Instagram or whatever, find their website. You can train with that person if you want to pay that price for them. Obviously, some charge more of a premium, some low cost, where you might not get as much interaction with them, whatever. So that's one good thing in that you can literally choose whoever you want. Now, the downside to that, for everyone that's looking to go into online coaching, is that now as an online coach, you're having to compete with that. So you're having to compete with a market where the consumer can train with literally anyone they want to in the entire world. So, and I don't know about you, during lockdown, I saw there was a few really well-known more fitness model types.
Yep.
So I would say there were, I would say their job would be influencer. If they were filling out their car insurance or whatever, they would call themselves an influencer. Suddenly their profiles, and let's say they had 500,000 followers, I think some of them had over 1 million followers. And I think there was about 5 of them that I noticed. Suddenly over lockdown, their profile changed to online coach.
Yeah.
From just being a fitness model, did the odd kind of fitness-based workout, something like that, but mostly it was clothing shots, they're in decent shape. Suddenly lockdown happens and they're an online coach. Now, people, as a consumer, you're probably looking at that person thinking, oh, they're in great shape, they're an online coach, I can work with that person. So, you know, that's a bad thing in that you're, you know, that as a consumer, you're looking at people like that might have a massive following, that might be in really good shape, and they don't actually have any fitness expertise. But, you know, the average consumer isn't necessarily going to know that. They're not consuming things like, I don't know, they're not reading things like T-Nation articles and things like that. They're not reading long form content. They're not going to this person's website. They're just seeing the fast stuff. They're seeing, you know, stuff that you don't need a massive attention span for, and thinking they're in decent shape. I want to look like them. I'm going to train with them. How much do I need to pay? So again, you know, that's a massive negative to things. So as a, you know, if you're a new online coach out there, that's the market that you're competing with. And I think the problem is you can't really compete with that market. You've got to be doing something completely different. You've got to really narrow it down. You've got to find your niche. You've got to find that one person that you're going to advertise to or going to speak to. You've got to, you know, whether it be starting out with your own family or just your Facebook friends or whatever, people that actually know you, like you and trust you, and then build your platform that way, rather than thinking I need to get 1,000,001 followers to train people. Because I'd rather have 200 followers and all of them listen to every word I said than have 1,000,000 followers and have no one listen to things that I say. So as I said, there's a lot out there and there's a lot of bad information, but there's also a lot of good. And for the average person, it's hard to distinguish between the two. My approach when it comes to social media, and same whether I'm writing for, and I keep mentioning, but T-Nation, because obviously you know them, is just what's interesting. What will people find interesting, and what will help someone? And that's my entire approach. And it tends to, it's built up an okay following on social media. People like that reading the T-Nation articles because it's something different, but then also it's useful and it's helping people. So I kind of rely on that rather than the clickbaity kind of stuff or posting loads of topless selfies and whatever.
Yeah. So is that the way you would kind of direct the consumer, is to go more towards long form content? Cause that was a big reason for me to start a podcast 2 years ago or whatever, to start writing blogs and, you know, doing more long form communication, because now I could actually show what I know. I couldn't hide behind, you know, rehearsing a 60-second video and taking my shirt off and saying something that sounds kind of good, but it's like, does he actually even know what the hell he's talking about? Like, now I have the opportunity for you to listen to me for 45 minutes talk by myself, and you're going to see if I'm full of shit or not pretty soon, pretty quickly, yes. Right? So is that a good way, or what would you suggest most the general population do to weed their way through the bad and get more of the good?
I think as an online coach, or someone that wants to advertise online coaching as a service and actually pick up clients, then you need long form content. And whether that long form content is a podcast, some kind of guide that you even give away for free, whether it be some kind of monthly subscription of some sorts, whether it be articles, whether it be YouTube videos, it really doesn't matter. And I would just suggest people just stick to the long form content that they prefer and they enjoy doing. So say a podcast, you know, that's your form of long form content. I like doing articles. I like sitting there and writing something, maybe thinking them out a little bit more, and then just add a little bit of video content on there. There are people that like just filming their days on YouTube or whatever for that long form content. Just do whatever you enjoy doing. And remember, as someone who creates a podcast, you can also create short form content from that podcast. And I think you do it anyway, like snippets from that podcast. So you've created your long form, and then you can chop it down into those shorter form content.
Gary stuff. Exactly.
Micro content.
Yeah, you get the macro content turned into micro content. Yep.
Exactly. And he's an absolute beast. And I think he even breaks down YouTube videos and podcasts into articles as well. And I think he uses a transcription service to convert it into an article. So he's just everywhere on things as well. But that, you know, that guy's on another level. Yeah. If you want to be selling, I don't know, a 99p a month app, then I think you're absolutely fine if you're just creating short form content. If you're just on Instagram, or if you're just on Snapchat or whatever, if you're just creating 15-second videos, I think it's absolutely fine, because people don't need to have as much trust in what you're doing. They just want a program. They want it cheap and cheerful. And, you know, the consumer doesn't mind if they've quote unquote wasted 99 cents or whatever.
So how do we prevent the consumer from wasting that money? In terms of like, what can the consumer really hone in on to make sure they're not just following some cookie cutter stuff?
For the average consumer, I would say you need to be doing your research on who you're listening to. And from a marketing standpoint, we're always taught that we need to get people to know us, to like us, and to trust us. You know, some people focus more on the knowing us. Your YouTube videos are great for that. Showing some of our personal lives are great for that. I personally don't do a lot of that stuff, but there are some people that solely rely on YouTube and doing house tours and what they eat in a day, and just being very, very open to what they're doing. And that helps the consumer know them, which in turn helps them maybe like them, maybe trust them more. I personally, as a coach, tend to prefer going down more of the education side of things. So, you know, you might know me a little bit by reading an article and having a bit of personality on that and liking me, but then you're also trusting me because I'm putting together a piece of knowledge. I'm giving you some knowledge from that as well. You might trust me more through seeing, I don't know, some of my credentials. There's various things that can kind of build on that know, like, trust. But I think it needs to be, as I said, that long form content that the average person needs to consume to actually genuinely get to know that person before taking the steps to, I don't know, apply for online coaching, or even if it's, you know, download a 99 cents a month app. They need to be properly consuming that person and understanding where they come from.
I think you make a good point there, just being more of a mindful consumer rather than, you know, buying with your eyes. You know, just immediately seeing something that you like and going, I want to look like that, or I want to listen to them, right? Do your homework a little bit. Speaking of mindful, I want to be mindful of your time, so I want to ask you a couple last questions here, because that new 12-week-year-old, they need your time. So
he's out at the moment anyway. His mum's taking him out for a walk, so I'm good.
Okay. So how did, I'm gonna grab the book first, Gareth. I got it right.
Yeah.
Just for the old YouTube to see, you know, so people can
Go
ultimate abs. There we go. Beautiful. So I jumped into it yesterday, you know, even for me, like, again, this is a lot of stuff that I know, and it's just kind of reiterating a lot of quality information, but it's really helpful because it makes you look at ab training in a different way, right? It really does, especially from the aspect of how people train their abs. So kind of going off that, how did the Ultimate Ab book kind of come to be? Was it something you always wanted to write about? You're like, you know, I really want to do something that's very specifically designed, like you talked about, a niche of building your abs, not core training, right? But building your abs. Or was it just, you know, I have this, you know, following, I've been doing some good work, and then I got approached with the idea of hey, let's do an ab book. What kind of came first there?
So it was actually really interesting how it happened. It was really good how it happened. At the start of probably 2 months before kind of COVID kicked off, or we were just starting to hear stuff about COVID, I was actually approached by Human Kinetics themselves. So I was approached by their acquisitions editor, and basically said, look, we like the idea of you writing a book for us on abdominal training, but we don't just give out books for people to write. You need to pitch it to us. So I was like, oh, okay, right, cool, all right. And at the time, I'd written a book for Dorling Kindersley. I'd written a book for Dorling Kindersley in 2013. Now, the book I wrote for DK in 2013 was called The Complete Running and Marathon Book. Now, to this day, I've still never run a marathon in my entire life. I hate running. Can't stand it. And that book was genuinely a case of who you know.
Yeah.
So I co-authored that book because I was working with someone at the time who was well connected with the publishing company. And there was kind of a small group of us. There's three of us that kind of have specialities in different areas of things. So one guy ended up writing the running section. I ended up writing the strength training section. And it was mostly on glutes, core work, et cetera, in that one. And then there's a physical therapist that wrote on, you know, foam rolling, recovery techniques, self-massage, all stuff like that. So it ended up being a really, really good book and well thought out. So I said that was in 2013. When writing that at the time, and the physical therapist is probably my best mate still, I remember speaking to him and being like, look, it's great that we're writing this book for DK, massive publisher, but I wish it was Human Kinetics. Because at the time, you know, when you're in college or in any known book in the strength and conditioning field, it's Human Kinetics. You know, all your big, thick, chunky books, that your Bibles, they're all by Human Kinetics. So it's like the kind of the gold standard. So when they approached me just before lockdown, I was like, fanboy, yes, 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 I'll do it. What do I need to do? Like, I'll pay you and I'll do it. So anyway, so as I said, it I was approached by them. You basically then have to write how you would structure the book and your kind of take on the book. So they were adamant they wanted it on abdominals, because everyone for the past 10-20 years has been writing on the core, and they wanted a pure abs book. And they wanted it aimed at kind of just above your men's health audience, like your educated menshealth.com audience. So it's a little bit more complex, but also not so complex that it needs to be a textbook, needs to be thick and loads of references in there. So pitched it, they loved the idea. And then as soon as COVID hit, and as soon as in the UK we had the first lockdown, I was starting to write a book. So I was stuck indoors, which was great at the time. I didn't have anything else to do. I was writing a book whilst managing my online clients. But as you say, it comes from the idea that most people, or most things are spoken about in terms of core training. And as far as I'm concerned with core training, it's brilliant. But core and abdominal training, completely different things. When we're talking about your core, we're talking about anything from, look, your lats. Your lats are technically part of your core. Your glutes are part of your core. Anything that affects that lumbar, pelvic, hip complex is part of your core. And we're talking about stabilization of your spine and your pelvis. When it comes to abdominals, you know, it's pure aesthetics. We want them to look good. So it's how can you train your abdominals to look as good as they can, to essentially hypertrophy those six-pack abs, your external obliques. But then also at the same time, as you'll see in the book, there's a core section and it shows how to combine that. So it's kind of you're training for both that show and go all at the same time. You know, as I said, there's a lot of research on core training. It's highly proven and effective. I do encourage it. I do it with a lot of people. But the way I see it is, I use this analogy all the time. If you want big biceps, you're not just going to be doing pull downs and pull ups. You're probably going to want to be doing some curls in there as well. Most people, you have the odd genetic freak that can do pull downs, pull ups and rows and their biceps get huge. But for most of us, and it's the same as your abdominals, you have the odd genetic freak that can just do some planks and they've got some great thick, chunky abs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as I said, when it comes to your biceps, you need to do some isolation, you need to do some curls. When it comes to your abs, then you want to be doing weighted crunch variations, you want to be doing leg raise variations, you want to be doing ab wheel rollouts and things like that, because you're actually trying to target a specific area and you are trying to get it to grow. And that's not into some thick, blocky, 40-inch waist. That's not going to happen. That's not how your abs grow. But you can get more deeply, deeply etched set of abdominals. And obviously part of that is diet. You know, that's a completely different conversation. And there is obviously some of that in the book and how to create deficit and things like that in the book. But as I say, it's very much aesthetics.
Very true. So what's the number one thing people are doing wrong when trying to build abs? This is the baby. And I know this book has a ton of different, reasons why people's abs aren't growing. And then also how you can do that effectively. But if you were to kind of really hone it down to like one major thing people are missing, what would you kind of say that is?
I'd probably narrow it down to two things. I'm going to use two things. Okay. Yep. So number one would be prioritizing them. Okay. Yeah. So let's be honest. When we train our abs, usually it's at the end of a workout, or we train our core, it's at the end of the workout. We're pretty tired, we're pretty fatigued, we kind of half-ass it sometimes, and most of the time we're doing it because we know we probably should do it. And whether that's training abs, core, whether it's doing planks and bird dogs or crunches, it doesn't matter. We normally would do them at the end. There are some exceptions. There are some people, especially it's quite popular in the powerlifting industry at the moment, and doing like the McGill Big Three at the start of a workout before you squat. So doing things like holding planks and holding bird dogs and things like that as your warm up. That's kind of becoming a little bit popular at the moment again. So there are some exceptions to that. But as I said, it's prioritizing that. So if you want to be building your abs, then you do need to be prioritizing it. So whether it be starting off your workout with some core or abdominal training, whether it be having a separate day of the week where you might do 20 minutes of training your abs and then you might do some conditioning work afterwards. It doesn't really matter, but you're actually, in your head, it's like, I'm training my abs today. I'm going to, that's what I'm going to do. It's not a half-assed thought. It's not something I'm throwing in at the end. And then as part of that comes point two, it's that progressive overload.
Yeah,
so your abs are literally like every other muscle. There's nothing special about them. We can talk about muscle fiber type and things like that and what reps they might respond to. And even that research is questionable. People are talking about training their calves using sets of 30 to 50 because there's a certain portion that's slow twitch and a certain portion that's fast twitch, etc. But that research is questionable. At the end of the day, every muscle needs progressive overload. Most muscles respond best to somewhere around 10 to 20 sets per week, give or take. People are different, but that's what most of the research says. And I think Brad Schoenfeld's done most of the research on that. And that's the same every single muscle. 50 sets of 100 crunches every single day or 4 days a week is not going to grow your abs. But if you went for, let's say you picked two exercises and you did 4 sets of each twice a week and you did some kneeling cable crunches and some leg raises or something, then your abs will start to grow, providing you keep track of the numbers, how many reps am I doing, what weight am I using, and just progressively try to increase that over a few weeks. You know, once you get stale or once you get bored, once things start to plateau, you can change things. You know, a kneading cable crunch can change to a, I don't know, a weighted crunch machine. It doesn't really matter. Everyone's completely different. But again, as I say, it's progressive overload. And part of that obviously comes along with actually being consistent and making that a priority within your workouts as well.
Those are two really good points, because you're so right, right? Most people, like I said, is thrown at the end of the workout just to get some ab work in. They just kind of throw it in there. And how often do you ever see people load their abs traditionally, right? It's basically a lot of people just kind of going towards the burn, and that's a shit ton of reps. And yeah, once you start feeling the burn, they go, oh my God, something's happening here. And it's almost equivalent to like doing banded kickbacks and, yeah, you know, abductions. Like it definitely helps sculpt the glutes, but if that's your primary way of building the glutes, you're not going to have very impressive glutes at the end of the day if you're skipping deadlifts and squats and hip thrusts, right? It just kind of makes sense.
You're exercising. You're not training. You know, you're not improving yourself. If you're someone, just as a simple example, if you're someone that's been doing, I don't know, three sets of 20 crunches at the end of your workouts for the last 5 years or something, then you need to kind of have a look at things. You need to step back, have a look at things, and be like, okay, actually, you know, clearly this isn't working. Maybe that person next week tries three sets of 20 and they hold a 1 kilo dumbbell here. Just something very, very, very simple.
Yep.
That's why I am a big fan of kneading cable crunches. The reason I'm a big fan of kneading cable crunches are because it's very easy just to, on the stack, go, oh, it's in that pin next week. Let's try it in that pin and see what happens.
Yeah.
It's very, very easy. You know, it puts you in a nice position, aligns things nicely. Hanging leg raises are a good one as well. Let's say you can do 12 next week. Well, let's see if you can get 13 or 14 next week. There's no issue if you're doing uneven reps, an uneven amount of reps. You don't have to go from 12 and then, oh, 13, 14 don't exist and have to hit 15. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be doing that. You can see if you can get 30, 40, 15, 16, whatever, and try and improve that way as well.
Love it. And that was actually my last podcast episode, was exercise versus training, right? And talking about the difference, because a lot of people, they exercise thinking they're going to get some sort of physiological adaptation. It's like, you're kind of just throwing shit at a wall and hopefully something sticks, or you've been doing something for 2 years straight, nothing's really changed, yet you think 2.5 years is going to make a difference. It's like, no, eventually you got to do progressive resistance training. This is going to be a good question for my mom. She loves cakes. She makes cakes, right? So you yourself, Gareth, are a cake connoisseur, correct?
Yeah, love a good cake.
How do you manage? This is a good one. This is a great question, I feel, because here you are, guy, great physique, you're in the industry. A passion of yours is to make cakes. Presumably you eat some of that cake as well.
Most of the cake, actually, yeah. I will eat most of the cake. If I've made a cake, it will tend to be, my girlfriend's quite petite anyway, she might end up eating maybe an eighth of that cake. But then I've eaten the rest of that cake probably within 2 days.
Oh my God, that's great. So, okay, so going off that, how do you manage the idea of not restricting yourself from eating things that you want? Because I feel like that's the problem. We kind of box people into these niches, right? I'm either keto, or I'm vegan, or I'm carnivore, or I'm paleo, or I'm no carb this week, or I'm high carb, whatever. And we get like this mucky little idea of what nutrition should look like, rather than figuring out a way to make it way more balanced and sustainable. So that way we don't just lose the weight, but we lose the weight when we keep it off and we live healthier lives. So how do you, because this is your specific example, kind of manage this idea of, you know, still eating things that you enjoy and, you know, still keeping a healthy, strong looking physique?
I think most people that strict in the extreme tends to bounce back in the extreme even harder.
Yeah.
I train a lot of IFBB pros, and they, you know, they are the extreme. They're very much, they are robots. If I tell them to eat 2000 calories, 200 grams of protein, whatever, and fill the rest in, then they will eat bang on every single day, which is great. They're absolute robots, but your average person isn't like that. Now these robots, and you know, I say it in the nicest of ways, they go to the extreme and they will get their body to the extreme, and they will omit things like they'll even take out sweeteners, for example. You know, we might cut protein bars and things like that with mannitol and things like that a few weeks prior. There are some people that I train who like to cut out chewing gum, so sugar-free chewing gum in the week or two prior. I'm not a fan of it, but they feel as though their body changes. So they're going to a massive, massive extreme by cutting out sugar-free chewing gum. Now, those people, they do tend to have a massive rebound. You know, we call it bulking season or improvement season, if you want to say we're putting those calories to use. And, you know, they do gain a lot of weight, but we also know that they can lose a lot of weight and they can take themselves to the extreme. The average person doesn't want to be doing that. They want to find that nice kind of healthy medium. And I'm a big fan of flexible eating and kind of to a degree, and if it fits your macros kind of approach. I think if you restrict too much, then you're always going to bounce back. You're not going to enjoy your lifestyle. You're not going to enjoy being on vacation, whatever. I'm a big foodie. I like going to places just to try the food. I will go on vacation somewhere specifically just to see what something tastes like there. So I'm never going to be restricting things. So I think just having a little bit of something is obviously going to be helpful in that long term, because it makes you feel as though things are less restrictive. So you're never going to be bouncing back with things. You know, if someone's, for example, I think the exception to that, I have had some clients that have busy lifestyles who do find having an eating window of saying 4 hours. So like a style of intermittent fasting is actually helpful for them, because they're not having to think about food so much. So they're able to eat. But the trouble is with that, as soon as they might eat outside of that window, that's it. Or, you know, I've screwed things up. I might as well just go to town on things. And then they suddenly screw things up. Same as people that are in keto, you know, suddenly they've had, the meal's had over 20 grams of carbs. I've screwed myself up completely. I might as well eat an entire cake.
Yeah.
So as I said, you know, you go to an extreme, you completely cut out carbs. That one little thing can completely make you fall off the bandwagon. So when it comes to me, yes, I have no issues with having a few slices of cake or having a few extra slices of cake than I should. I might compensate a little bit the day after to say, you know, I'm quite good at eating intuitively. If I know I've had two or three slices of cake, I might have had, say, 800 calories of cake. The next day, I might just eat just a little bit less, but I'm not that worried about it. You know, I'm not letting it beat me up. I'm not letting it be like, okay, catastrophe, everything's falling apart. I've ruined my body now, screw the diet. You just kind of get back on things because it's logical to kind of just get back on track. When I'm dieting, let's say I've got a photo shoot or something, yes, I'm tracking absolutely everything. I will track the 9 calories in the 1,000 milligram fish oil, that capsule that I have in the morning. I will track everything. But if I want to have a slice of cake, I'll track that as well. I'll just make sure it fits within things.
Gotcha. And I think the caveat to all that as well is you have a wealth of experience of how to do this as well. You have a lot of lean muscle tissue, meaning you're going to have a thriving, faster metabolism, and you have a healthy relationship with food and fitness, right? I think that's a big part of that successful package right there.
It all works together, doesn't it? Because I think it depends who you're speaking to, but the average person that, say, works out 3 days a week, they're not thinking about the gym all the time. They're not wanting to think about food all the time. They're not wanting to think about their next meal all the time. So you and I, you know, we have that advantage in that we're in it more. We understand things a little bit more. And when it comes to your average person, you know, they do want simple, digestible advice that works for them as well, don't they?
Sure.
I think that's why, you know, keto and things like that work for people, or people that have not necessarily work. People do them because it's easy to understand. Don't eat carbs. It's easy for them to understand and they think it works.
No, you're 100%. I honestly believe that. When you make it that clear of eat this, don't eat that, it works really well. That's why meal plans initially work really well. It's like, tell me what to eat. And like, as a coach, I've really gone away from that with new clients. I'm trying to build this like not necessarily intuitive way of eating, but more of a sustainable way of eating. And I don't feel like me giving you what to eat 7 days a week is very sustainable. So I tell them, I'm like, guys, I can give you a meal plan. You're going to look pretty good over the next 2 months, but eventually you're going to go, Brandon, what? I can't keep eating like this. And I'm going to tell them, well, I don't want you to eat like this all the time. So we need to find this balance of trying to get you to think more about what you're eating and how it makes you feel rather than just how it's going to make you look. Because usually if you focus on things that are going to make you feel really good, the byproduct is you're going to look pretty damn good as well, right?
Exactly. It's as you say, you know, I do the exact same thing when it comes to nutrition. It's you know, when we're talking about quantity, we're talking about your macronutrients, proteins, fats, carbs, you know, but also at the same time, if we're telling someone, eat this amount of calories, protein, fats, carbs, track it all in my fitness pal, people automatically like, what, how do I do that? What do I need to eat? So you still get that person asking, oh, can I have a meal plan? So I end up doing something that almost is not a meal plan, but here's a list of ideas. Your day might end up looking like this, but I don't want it to look like this. I want you to, I want you to maybe start here, but you know, use it as ideas, but also try and find what you like, you know, explore things, educate yourself. Because when they start using MyFitnessPal and logging things, it's not necessary to, you know, if they're going overboard with the calories, it really doesn't bother me too much to start off with. But what they're doing by logging everything, they're becoming more aware of what things they're eating and what's in what they're eating. So suddenly they're like, oh, you know, that chocolate bar was just 200 calories. Whereas for that, I can have 6 rice cakes, you know, and suddenly it's like, oh, okay, wow, all right, I can have 6 rice cakes instead of that one small chocolate bar, and I can feel a lot fuller and, you know, be eating for longer. So things just kind of start falling in place, as you say.
Yes, that's a great point. So they're slowly becoming more educated and more mindful in the process, and that's where we ultimately want to get people, right? Like, I don't want you to train with me 10 years from now. If you do, that's phenomenal, and I'll be here and I'll be happy to do that. But the goal is that you want to do that with me for 10 years, not that you need to do that. I think that's the big difference, right? I want to be able to educate you enough where you can go on your own, but you know, you like who I am and you like what I do, that maybe you want to work with me longer, right?
Yeah, we want to make ourselves out of a job. Essentially, we want to educate our clients as much as they can, that they can put things together, especially when it comes to food. I think I'm slightly different in terms of training, in that a lot of the clients that I train online, just like, you know, they're IFBB pros. They know what they're doing. They know how to write a pretty decent training program. They're trainers themselves. They just want to be told what to do. So they're not so much about the education. They just want to not have to think about it when they do their own workout. They're thinking about it so much during the day that when they do their workouts, they just want to open up my app or open up a PDF or whatever and just see what they want to do for that day. And because, as I said, they're like robots. They just want to know that by doing that, they've ticked the box for that day, and they, you know, and they get to kind of where they want to be.
For sure. And it keeps them on track, right? Rather than chasing all these shiny objects, it's like nice to know that you get someone who put a plan together for you, and you're less likely to kind of, you know, deviate away from it, right? If it's kind of already.
And that's the problem with social media, isn't it? Problem with social media. Because suddenly you see, and I have a couple of clients actually that, oh, I saw your exercise today. You did this. I did that today instead of doing this that you wrote in the plan. I was like, no, you're just meant to just follow the plan. I know it's kind of flattery. You're copying what you've seen on, you know, seen me do, but just stick to your plan. If I want you to do that exercise, I'll tell you to do that exercise.
That's hilarious. So Gareth, where can people find you? What's next on the horizon? What do you got planned? Where can people kind of like follow your journey, and what can they look forward to?
You can link to everything of mine on at thefitnessmaverick.com. So thefitnessmaverick.com. I'm the Fitness Maverick on all social media, Facebook, Instagram. I've just got TikTok. God help me. We'll see where that goes. I'm not too enthusiastic over it, but we'll see. For the young kids thinking about the future, they might be on there if they're sure, young kids, sure. Online coach in the future. So thefitnessmaverick.com is everything. I'm actually trying to go down more the seminar route and workshop route over the next few years, just because, as I said, there's mostly my following is coaches and things like that, that as you say, kind of need to be learning off of, I'm not saying I'm that person, but they need to be learning from, you know, more educated resources, better resources, and things like that. So, and also down the business route as well, with that as well, just having been where I have done, you know, if people want to learn off of someone, try and emulate the person that's done what you want to be doing. If you want to write a book, you know, I've written a couple of books. If you want to be in some big bodybuilding websites, I've done that. You know, I've owned a gym. I've owned, you know, various kind of personal training studios. You know, I'm relatively successful at online coaching and have good retention with those people. So that's my thought, in that people might like to learn off of someone like me that's actually been there and done that, rather than someone that's just gone and got a undergraduate degree in marketing and never trained someone in their entire lives. And I'm selling you, I don't know, a $10,000 program of how to become an online coach, yes, you know, or online coaching marketing or something. So that's kind of the route I want to go down in terms of like giving back to personal trainers and things like that. But as I said, we'll see. Just kind of exploring that avenue at the moment. But all my updates are on thefitnessmaverick.com.
Very cool. And that's super valuable. You're 100% right. I think people learning from a guy like yourself who's been successful in that space is going to save people a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of hardship. It's going to, you know, expedite the process so much more. So if you are a trainer listening to this, definitely, like I said, follow Gareth and, you know, go to his webinars, do his thing, because he's going to lead you in the right direction. So yeah, this was awesome, everybody. So we'll see you in the next episode of the Fear Being Average podcast. Gareth, man.